Praise the Lord. I'm Andrew Womack. We are going to have a panel discussion here with these men that you see around me, and I am so excited about this. It's going to be awesome. If it's anything like what we've been discussing as we were eating just a while ago, it's going to be wonderful. So real quickly, I'm going to give you an introduction, but these men, we could spend a lot of time on each one of them, but just to give you a little bit of background who they are, this is Tim Barton and David Barton right here on this end. They're with Wall Builders, and they are just great historians, and I mean, God is using them. They have radio broadcast, of course, travel, and they're just being used mightily by God. This is E.W. Jackson, and he is a pastor. And I always get this wrong. Is it
Chesapeake, Virginia?
There you go. And I love EW. We have become great, great friends, and you will be blessed by him. And he is being used. He's also a broadcaster, has a program every day. This is Alex McFarland, who has a broadcast. He's been holding biblical worldview conferences all around the world, spoken in over 2,000 churches. And he's now working with us and kind of coordinating our biblical worldview. This is Abraham Hamilton, and he's a lawyer, a pastor, and also a broadcaster, has a daily broadcast. And I'm just getting to know him, but Abraham has come super highly recommended. And then we got William Federer down here, and he is qualified in many different directions. He, like the Bartons, is a historian. But my claim to fame for Bill is the American Minute. I've been reading it every day for years, and I have learned a tremendous amount of world history through Bill Federer. He's a blessing. So we really have some of the best experts, I think, on the planet right here. And this section of our biblical worldview is dealing with socialism. And so I want to start off and just kind of define what socialism is, because I think that there's, you know, the statistics show that a lot of the young people, the majority, have said that they would embrace socialism, and I don't think they know what they're even talking about.
If we can hit that real quick on numbers, numbers over recent years and months show that about 75% of college students prefer socialism to capitalism or free market. About 69% of the group called millennials, which that's kind of the 22 to 24, maybe to 38, 39, 69% of that group, and overall in the nation, about 41% prefer socialism over capitalism, free market. But here's where the issue comes with those numbers. And those numbers are disturbing because there's 5,800 years of recorded history. There's not a single instance in history of any nation that's gone to socialism that has preserved individual liberties and individual prosperity. That's always the consequence of moving there. So for such a large percentage of the American people to be supporting it, that's disturbing. Until you find out, they really don't know what it is. One of our good friends, George Barnum, does a lot of polling. He took that 41% that says, I support socialism, general Americans. And I love Barnum's polls because he didn't let you get away with just saying what you believe. You got to see whether you really know what you're talking about. And so he went back with 47 additional questions to those people and said, do you think that there should be greater government ownership of private property? Do you think that there should be greater government regulation in private business? He went through 47 things socialism does without telling them it was socialism. At the end, that 41%, only 2% wanted what socialism was. They just didn't know what it was. And so what he found out was the two most common understandings of what socialism is one, it means sharing with others. Well, we're all socialists if that's the case, because we all want to share, but that's not what it is. And the second was it means being social with other people, like social media or whatever. So they had no clue what it was, what it stood for, what it would do, what the consequences were, what it takes to, and they couldn't even define it. So that's where we are with socialism now. We buy into it, we think it's great, we just don't know what it is.
That reminds me of the reporter that asked the Pope if his wife was with him. People don't know much
don't
about
know.
It. So, Bill, could you give us a real quick definition of what socialism is?
Socialism is counterfeit church. It is involuntary versus voluntary. The church, you care for each other because the Lord gives you property. When they come into the promised land, they got private property, and you can be moved upon to give away some of it. That's called charity. Socialism involuntarily takes away it and redistributes it. Whenever the government does anything, it's in exchange for something. You're in Egypt, you're starving, you need food. We'll give you food in exchange for your cattle, your land, your children, your lives. When the church helps people, it wants them to get up out of their situation and become successful so they can help the next needy person that comes along. But socialism is a sales campaign for dictatorship. It's top down, where God's model is bottom up. And it is a recurring theme throughout history. I liken it to if older fish could tell younger fish to stay away from shiny things dangling in the water, like fishing lures. But they can't. So every new generation of younger fish sees this sparkly thing and they go out and bite it, and it's a hook, right? So socialism is a sparkly thing dangling in the water. It's free food, free education, free welfare, free healthcare. Free is attractive. The only problem is there's a hook there. And I love the quote from Gerald Ford, where he said, "The government that's big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have."
That's true.
Yeah, Andrew, if I could, the other thing that really strikes me is it's based on a couple of very false premises, which are completely antithetical to Christianity and the church. One is, if you can just get the system right, you can make people perfect. I mean, we can have utopia. It'll be a wonderful world, because after all, our problems are not because people are imperfect. Our problems are that we have a bad system, and the system is producing bad people. And that's what capitalism does, because it's based on greed. But if you can have socialism where everybody shares with one another, we'll just have utopia. So that's the false premise, you see, that has been tried and ends up in totalitarianism.
Well, aren't people basically good?
Right, exactly.
What does the scripture say about that?
Well, if I could just say, the other false premise is obviously you don't need God. You just, you know, the government can do it. You don't need God. And those things, of course, are deadly for society.
Well, Bill mentioned a sales pitch for dictatorship. Teen Vogue is a magazine that about 2 years ago ran an article titled "The Effects of Capitalism and What It Does to People," as if capitalism is like some disease or something like that. And EW, you're right. I mean, the socialists believe in the perfectibility of man, that everything can be this utopia on earth, and the problems have been people making a profit. Because you remember Occupy Wall Street, September through November 2011, they said, "People, not profits." And there's the assumption, and this is very pervasive among young people, even Christian young people, that if a business, I've asked audiences of young people, if a business has made a profit, is that necessarily a bad thing? And the majority of young people say, yes. I'm like, really? Because they've been coached and groomed that profit only came at the expense of somebody else. Profit is a bad thing. And we have to tell a whole new generation that principled capitalism, capitalism based on this Judeo-Christian culture, principled capitalism is a great thing. Gives jobs, creates wealth, enables us to have prosperity. But we are being sold a bill of goods right now.
Well, and just like people don't know how to define socialism, they also don't know how to define capitalism. And so when they see people being greedy in the marketplace, well, that's what capitalism is. No, that's people being greedy in the marketplace, right? That's sinful flesh. And when people, working with young people, Alex, you mentioned on college campuses, when you talk with young people and you float the idea of, wouldn't it be cool if you came up with an invention and you could patent that invention, and that invention was something that benefited everybody's life, and then everybody wanted to buy that from you, and all of a sudden you became very wealthy, and you phrase the question, who did you hurt in doing this? Well, because when you understand that true capitalism is the more people that you bless, the more people bless you with the financial contribution for the good that you are blessing them in their life. In true capitalism, you don't get wealthy by hurting people. You get wealthy by blessing people. But again, people don't know how to define capitalism. They don't know what socialism is. And when people see capitalism and negative results, it's usually because of government interference into capitalism that has produced those negative results. Because when the government begins to pick winners and losers and say, we're going to favor this business and not this business, we saw this in the midst of the COVID shutdowns, right? When some of these big tech, these big businesses stayed open and mom and pop shops couldn't, when the government gets to pick winners and losers, years, that's when you have a lot of challenges in capitalism. But most young people aren't anti-capitalism by concept, it's by title. By title, people are in favor of socialism and they're against capitalism, but they don't really know what those things are fundamentally. And when you, like George Barna has done, when you ask the questions of, well, are you really in favor of the government controlling more of your life and taking away property and means of production? Most people aren't really there, it's just they don't know what those things are.
One of the other consequences of socialism that people, I'd say it's an unintended consequence, is with socialism, you lose individuality. And I don't know of any group that wants to be less of an individual. They want to be recognized, they want to be affirmed, they want to be an individual. Socialism, you deal with a group, you don't deal with individuals. It's the free market system or capitalism that looks at individualism. Under socialism, which is government control of means of production, the government decides winners and losers in business. So entrepreneurship doesn't exist, and yet 70% of millennials say their dream is to be entrepreneurial and own their own business. Well, you're not going to get that under socialism, but they don't know that. And so what happens is they want to be something, they want to be individual, and they want the government to help them. That, no, the government's not going to help them. If it becomes socialism, it washes everything to the level of mediocrity. One of the teachings of Jesus that I really like on this is in Luke 19, Matthew 25, where that he calls, and by the way, notice how often in the Bible it says, Jesus says, and the kingdom of God is like, and then he gives them a business example. And he so many of his parables are based on business and business practices. And one of them, he calls his servants to him and he says, okay, I'm going to be gone for a while. I'm giving every one of you a mina in Luke 19 or a talent in Matthew 25. You guys do business till I come back. So do business, invest this, see what you can make with it. And so when he comes back and looks, and mina back then would be the equivalent of about $10,000 a day, but he gave each one of them $10,000 and said, go invest it, see what you can make. He comes back, one guy takes it, turns it into 10. So big tenfold production, one turns it into 5 and one didn't do anything with it. And it's interesting that the guy who turned it into 10, he said, I'm going to make you ruler of 10 cities. You've done more. I'm going to reward you with more. You're going to get individual rewards for what you've done. The one guy who had 5 got 5 cities, and one guy who didn't do anything said, I want government to take care of me. And he says, no, it's not going to happen. Out of here. And so he took the guy that had done nothing and gave it to the guy who had 10. And when people said, wait a minute, that's not fair, he's getting more, he says, yeah, to him who has will more be given. He rewards productivity. And so the system that the harder you work, the more rewards you get out of it, it's totally up to you. If you want to be lazy and expect rewards, that's not going to happen in the free market system. But if you want to be a hard worker and not be rewarded, that doesn't go over well. And so what you find is everyone drifts toward mediocrity. In American history, we see this with the Pilgrims and Jamestown colony. They were into socialism. And when the Pilgrims discovered 2 Bible verses that led them into what we call the free market system, their productivity went up 7 times simply by changing economic systems. They became the most prosperous of all the early colonies, individually prosperous because they got into a free market system. So it's the kind of thing where the people hear the sound bites that go with it, read the memes that go with it, they don't understand. And even the contradiction of, I want my own business and I like socialism, it'll never happen. You got to have one or the other.
Well said. And I was just going to underscore something Bishop Jackson said, that one of the major false premises is that it assumes inherent virtue in mankind. You know, one of the greatest benefits of capitalism is that it takes into consideration the fallenness and the sinfulness of mankind, and then in keen awareness of that, utilizes it in motivating productivity. Where the converse is true in the socialist structure, where you have equality of outcomes, you mean I'm gonna get the same thing no matter what I do? Oh, that's surely an incentive for me to do more, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Which is why it's not surprising when you had in nations where socialism has been tried and implemented, that productivity always diminishes, because humanity is the same all over the world, which is why everywhere socialism has been tried, it's failed miserably. And it is very, very foolish for people in our country to seek to employ something that we have witnessed fail historically, and we are currently witnessing in countries like Venezuela failing now. Why would we want to repeat that foolishness?
And some people also point to socialistic systems, like maybe they have socialized medicine and they go, well, that's socialism, look at it working. No, that's socializing one aspect of the market, and you pay dearly for socializing that aspect, because if you look at those European nations where there is a level of socialism, maybe socialized medicine, that everybody gets health care no matter what, no matter your job, not job, you get coverage. In those European nations, you might pay up to 60 or 70% of a tax rate for your free health care. So what that tells me is there was nothing free about that healthcare, but that's where people also confuse that you can socialize an industry and not be entirely a socialist nation. Now, socializing an industry, I would still argue, doesn't do a really good job for the nation. It doesn't help you. It doesn't incentivize people to be productive, as you were pointing out. But this is where even we have confused in America with our lack of understanding of the world, of cultures around us, that we see somebody doing something and think, oh, that's what this must be, without always having the information to decipher what was actually happening, where there are some nations that actually it looks like they are functioning fairly well, but it's because maybe their nation only has 1 million people. And all 1 million people have embraced the idea that I don't mind giving the government 60 to 70% of every dollar I earn.
You know, let me just break in with a testimony that I had an employee in the UK that he actually went and figured out what percentage of his salary went towards healthcare, and it was 41% off the top of his salary, not of his taxes, but his salary went to healthcare. And then he got sick. I went and visited him in the hospital, and it was like a triage in a war zone. It was not the same quality as we have. I had a second employee that needed a gallbladder surgery, and she waited 2 years because it wasn't one of the life-threatening things. And finally, she went and paid for it herself. And so I have firsthand experience that this so-called healthcare system is not what it's presented.
The other insidious aspect to this is it robs people of their individuality. Amen. Because you're not supposed to be considered as an individual. You're right. Part of a group, right. Which is exactly the opposite of how God views us. I mean, we're fearfully and wonderfully made, each of us. And so collectivism is now being used, and this is Marxism, of course, is now being used in America to divide us by race, to divide us by gender, keep everybody at each other as if there's this limited pie and everybody's fighting for it. And if you have more, it's because you took it from someone else, and you took it from usually from a particular group of people. You took it from the Native Americans. You took it from Black people. You took it from Hispanic people. And so you've got this system where everybody's set against each other. So rather than working together, and even the corporate world, as you all are pointing out, in order to be accepted, buys into this. I mean, they're profiteers, they're capitalists, they're free enterprise people, but they feel the need to, like NASDAQ recently said, we want all of the companies that trade on our board to have at least one transgender trade on our exchange, to have at least one transgender, one Black, one this, one that, because it's not the individual that matters anymore. It's the collective impact of what we're doing, and it robs people of their humanity.
It's enforced egalitarianism. Everything is going to be equal, even if we have to force you to do it.
Compulsory, yeah.
Yes.
One of the aspects that goes down with socialism is the excellence that comes with competition, because you were mentioning healthcare. If you have an intersection of two streets, you have four corners, and a burger joint opens on one corner, and it's the only burger joint in town, and they make lousy burgers, and that's all you got the choice of, you may go there. But if somebody sits up across the street and makes great burgers at half the price, guess what? This guy's going to say, you know what? I need to make my burgers better. And what happens is it drives costs down and it drives quality up. You get a better product for less. I have a friend that was needing, he actually talked to a congressman and said, look, what we need is price competition in medicine. That would help it. And so he had an MRI and some blood work had to be done. And when he went to the hospital, he said, before you do that, how much is it going to cost? I may want to pay for this by myself. And say, I don't know. We always build business. Well, tell me how much it's going to cost. And so they finally came back a couple days later. Here's what we're going to charge you. And he went to a clinic down the street and said, how much will you charge? And by the time it was over, it went from like $15,000 down to $900. And so his health care price was dramatically decreased. Suddenly, all the clinics wanted his business, wanted his work. So the service is better. They offer him more stuff for it. And when you get into socialism, you lose the excellence that comes with competition. And the price that goes down with competition, you can get more for less and get better stuff. And you don't get that with socialism.
Which is why when you have in these compulsory egalitarian societies, oftentimes the wealthiest among them come to the U.S. to get some of the most skilled needed, the most expensive, the most highly technically advanced procedures often happen here, even among people who live in nations we have so-called free healthcare. And that's why, because of that push towards excellence.
And, you know, I've been going to the UK 2 to 3 times a year for probably 25 years. And there are very few times that I've been there that I haven't heard a story about somebody who needed a surgery, but they weren't considered a good enough percentage that it would work, and so they just decided not to give it to him. And I've seen little children die and people that could have had bone marrow transplants, but that was a relative thing. And you don't have the choice. The health system decides whether your life is important enough.
They'll do a cost-benefit analysis. Will the cost of this procedure cause you to live long enough for us to collect the amount of money that we're going to spend on it? And if the tabulation doesn't work out right, well, you just take these pain pills and deal with
Actually, that good point, because it points out that people become a commodity to government. Rather than being an asset or value, you're only good to us for what we can get out of you. And you're no longer an individual. You're just a commodity, like a herd of cattle or anything else. And that is another attitude that goes when you shift from a free market, competitive, capitalistic system to a socialistic system. The way government views the individual goes way down.
It robs people of that freedom to choose based on my own individual needs, wants, desires, aspirations, to start that burger restaurant. You know what? I think I can make a better burger. Yeah. In fact, let's face it, some of the greatest businesses ever started were started because some guy said, I can do that better than he's doing.
That's
it. Whereas this socialism says, no. You shouldn't even be competing. Everybody ought to get a trophy. Yeah. Everybody ought to be treated exactly the same. And yet here again, even God doesn't do that, as the parable that you just talked about pointed out. And part of the problem is we suppress the giftedness of individuals by forcing them to mold themselves to satisfy some sort of collective identity they're supposed to have. You're black, you're poor, you're this, you're that, this is where you fit, you do that. And yet, here again, some of the greatest, you were talking about our medical situation. We are 4% of the world population, I think, still. Over 50% of the patents happen here. Why? Because somebody wakes up and thinks, I have an idea, and I think I'll pursue that, rather than, oh no, you're not supposed to be doing that, because after all, we think this way and this way only. Abraham and I were talking about that earlier. This idea, for example, that we as black men, we're supposed to think a certain way. But that denies us our humanity, because we don't think the same way. We have individual thoughts based on individual experiences and our backgrounds. So
that's like saying all white people are all prejudiced.
Well,
there is no individuality.
Deal.
They just, everybody becomes a part of a group.
I think that's part of it.
Bishop, you talk about people inventing things and holding patents. And here in America, so many young people say, well, it's wrong to make a profit. But the way so many businesses and ministries begin, people put their own money out there. They put some skin in the game. They put their own resources at risk. And then they engage in what we call self-control and deferred gratification. They say, look, I'm going to live within my means. I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to get up early. I'm going to work late. I'm not going to go buy a new car and go in debt. I'll do that later once I'm able to afford it. And I think about how capitalism, and I call it principled capitalism, has given the world out of the USA things like air conditioners, airplanes, computers, televisions, not to mention medical advances. And it wasn't the strong fist of government that did that. It was initiative, entrepreneurialism, individualism. And as the twice Pulitzer nominated historian Rodney Stark says, the iron Protestant work ethic.
Yeah.
That's what gave us the world we enjoy.
Well, you were talking about that ethical capitalism, if you will. It's interesting that the more biblical your country is, the more of a free market capitalistic system you have. And the less biblical and more secular you are, the more of a socialistic system you have. Because again, when you go back to the teachings of Jesus, they bring liberty, they bring abundance, they bring all sorts of stuff. But as you look at the teachings throughout, there are so many that deal with economic issues. And so few people read the Bible as a guidebook. They read it more like a spiritual devotional, and they get blessed by it, but they don't think about how to apply it in life. And so as you go through and look at biblical principles, the principle of competition is there, the principle of reward is there. Even as Alex, you were saying, young people, they don't like the idea of somebody making a profit. And yet, if they were to make a profit and you took it away from them, I guarantee you they would object to that. Yeah. You know, it's like they've never thought through it because they haven't been in that position. But if you work harder than someone and attain more, that is biblical. And so but it takes ethics, which means things like the Ten Commandments. Because I believe I account to God, I'm not going to rip you off or give you something inferior, because I'll have to stand before God and he says, why did you give an inferior product to one of my children? And I don't want to have to answer for that. So I'm going to give you high quality stuff. I'm going to give you good stuff. The more cognizant I am of God and answering to him, the better I'm going to be in business and the more I'm going to serve rather than want to be served. Amen. And so that literally, the more biblical you are as a nation, more biblical thinking, the more you have good ethical capitalism, ethical mm-hmm. free market system.
I think that's a great point to raise because Tim made the point earlier that a lot of the objections, especially among the young people that are being presented concerning capitalism, it's based on sinfulness and greed. And they conflate that with being synonymous with capitalism. And that's not the case at all. But it is important to note that what we have, that the culture that we live in today, it's crying out for conciliation void of the cross. You have people that have real instances of pain and real instances of suffering, real instances of poverty. And you have a culture that is being cultivated to have some type of moralistic response to it, but void of the cross. And so it shouldn't be lost on us that the acclimation towards embracing socialism as a term or a concept is coinciding with the increasing secularization of our country.
Let me say to Bill here that, you know, this isn't a new concept, socialism. It's been tried before and it's never worked. Could you give us a little perspective on this?
Sure. Well, it goes back to Plato, 380 BC, and in passing, he writes about Atlantis, this highly structured society that sinks in the ocean. And then he talks about democracy. He says that democracy is an unstructured system. The chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance. Then they tolerate people that are a little bit off. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off, till finally they're tolerating crooks and crime and fraud and broad daylight looting, and it turns into chaos. And then the people say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And that's when some governor comes along and he says, I can fix it. I just need some emergency powers. And he ends up, I'm going to take away your freedoms, but I'm doing this to protect you. Finally, he stands in the chariot of state holding the reins of power. He's revealed as the tyrant. And this tyrant will institute a structured society. And he is the head of gold. His administrator, deep state, are the arms and chest of silver. They're the ruling class. And everyone else is the abdomen of iron and bronze. They are the ruled class. So socialism is a structured society with a ruling class and a ruled class. And Plato says that the ruled class own no property. They have no families. The government takes the kids away from the families and brings them into the cities where they're indoctrinated with noble lies. We want one grand lie, which will be believed by everybody. But anyway, that's the origin of socialism. 2,000 years later, you got, were you going to?
Well, I was just going to point out that the argument today, though, would be people would say, but we want democratic socialism. That's a totally different kind of socialism.
Who would ever say something like that?
Right? Bill, this is to me one of the great ironies when we hear, especially young generations, talking about socialism as if there's this new novel solution we found to solve all the failures of previous generations of socialism. And because of ignorance of people that are saying those things, they don't recognize that socialism was always a step on the road towards something else.
Yes.
Right? Where Karl Marx and Marxism says this is number 5 of the 6 objectives of communism, and this is just on the road to communism. And certainly as you go through history, you can see where socialism, although it sounds maybe a more friendly version before the tyrant, it always leads, at least from my understanding, historically to that tyrant, which I don't mean to interrupt where you were going, but just I think what a lot of people today would say, but it's different because it's democratic socialism. No, socialism always leads down that same road, and you won't like where it ends up.
Yeah, you can be socialist and free. And the fact of the matter is, you can't.
Right. Lenin said socialism is a transition phase to communism. And Karl Marx says communism can be summed up in one sentence, abolition of private property. Mm-hmm. But the Bible, God gives private property, and you're empowered. All property is a way for you to express what's in your heart. I call it money is a magnifier. Right? You're a godly person, you'll give away the money to help the poor. right? You're a selfish person. You'll use the money for evil. I call it capitalism with a conscience. You take away the conscience and they'll sell people into slavery, sell drugs and sex trafficking. So capitalism as itself doesn't work, but it's an expression of what's in the heart. And so the idea is we want to change the heart. But one of the things I think is important is the French Revolution. We had a revolution. France had a revolution. They actually helped us in our revolution, and all they got in exchange was debt, lots of it. And then they had a couple years where the crops failed. And then they said, if only we can chop off the king's head, things will be solved. And they do. It doesn't get any better. Then they chop off the heads of the royalty and the wealthy. You're selfish. You got money. We don't. Then they chop off the heads of the businessmen and farmers. You got food and supplies. We don't. You're selfish. Anyway, they chop off enough heads. And the motto of the French Revolution was liberty, equality, fraternity. In America, so fraternity is their word for socialism, the fraternity, the group, the collective. Equality can be understood two ways. In America, equality is equal treatment before the law. In France, it was everyone having an equal amount of stuff. And if the fraternité, the group, the collective, thinks you have too much stuff, it'll use the power of the state to take away your stuff and redistribute it and kill you. And then they went to the Vendée and killed 300,000 people, considered the first modern genocide. So that's the model for every socialist takeover, that you kill off the old order, and then you're going to have this utopia. But what happened in France turned into chaos, and out of it, you get a dictator named Napoleon.
You know, with Bill bringing up history as he did, this is another good thing to know about socialism, because America not only becoming more secular, but becoming more historically illiterate. There's no question about that. And one of the things about history we see in the Bible, now you can go to the Bible and see that there's a lot of subjects that should be taught in the Bible, but maybe the one that's talked about most often is history. Recall the former days, remember the former times, tell your children what's happened in the past. And history is a good preventative in many ways. I can put my hand on a hot stove and learn that it burns, or I can read about people who have done it and not have to do it myself. And so knowing that no other nation in the history of the world has ever gone to socialism and been prosperous and free, well, it'll happen if we, no, gravity, law of gravity is going to work every time. If you jump off a building and think you're going to fly, you won't, you're going to hit. And so that's where even our knowledge or lack of knowledge of history, our historical literacy is contributing to this movement towards socialism, because we don't know anything in the past. We don't know about Rome. We don't know about France. We don't know about the 44,000 beheadings. We don't know any of that.
So how does all of this cancel culture fit into this? I mean, is it erasing our history and laying the ground?
I got a great quote. I got to share this. Will Durant, who I really love, a great historian. He said, "The Americans are the world's most well-informed people about the last 24 hours and the least well-informed people about the last 6,000 years." And that's really true. And when I've spoken at universities, I've done Q&A, and there was a time when I got my mic cut off when I began to talk about God and country, all the America's Godly Heritage that I learned by reading David Barton and Bill Federer. And yet, when I really began to lay facts and dates and names and places on the table, we were suddenly out of time. And I think that there are a lot of people that they want the American people to be ignorant of not only world history, but our own history, Seth.
Yeah.
But that's part of socialism is not just economic.
Right.
I mean, it's cultural.
Right.
And so, you know, you talk about our ignorance of history. Well, we're not really ignorant. We're misinformed. Because I think I was thinking of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States and how he has poisoned a whole generation. I had a kid joined my church who was in the Navy, and he stayed there for about 3 years while he was stationed near us. And before he left, he said, "I want to thank you." I said, "For what?" He said, "Because when I joined this church, I hated my country." And I said, "Really, why?" He said, "Because I had read and studied Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States of America, and I thought to myself, what a horrible country this is, how horrible this whole system is." He said, "Until I started coming here, because I weave a lot of history into my messages," he said, "I never saw any positive thing that I should admire, and you taught me that America's a great place, and I've got a whole new attitude about being in the Navy and so forth." So my point is, yeah, economics is critical, But there's a whole cultural set of ideas undergirding that. And when you start to erode that, that's where you get a negative attitude, not only about capitalism and free enterprise, but about the entire country right. that supports it.
And what you raise is an intentional part. You know, prior to World War I, you have Karl Marx and others wanting to have their Marxist utopia. And then something amazing happened. World War I occurs. And then all of these Europeans are exposed to the West by many of them for the first time. And they learn, wait a minute, even if I'm poor, I'm not perpetually and irrepressibly poor. I have friends and family members who've made it to America, and in one generation, they've changed everything. And so then you had people like Georgie Lukacs and others who developed this idea of cultural terrorism to get people to question Western civilization and stripping them from a lot of the historical anchors and things of that nature to execute Gramsci's long march through the institutions to create this kind of cultural penchant also that aids them in executing their economic agenda. And so that is a part of the plan to unmoor people from its history and even deprive them of properly navigating contemporary history. Putting the descriptor democratic in front of socialism doesn't change the nature of socialism. I mean, in Venezuela, they voted for Chavez initially. Does that change the results? Absolutely not, because the ideology is equally as pernicious whether you vote for it initially or not.
It's like social justice, which means it's not really justice at all. It's an agenda.
Right.
That you're trying to use the concept justice to support and to implement.
Well, and when the government is able to step in, and we, as you mentioned, not just in the sense of economically, but now when we're seeing a government that is completely contrary to historically what should be happening, the purpose of government, right? The role of government, the function, constitutionality of what government is, one of the things that is very consistent in studying history with socialism is, or communism, right, the dictators, the tyrants, whatever the case is you mentioned the more secular you are, the more you embrace socialism, communism, whatever it is, because as a nation, there's only two options. Either you serve God or you serve government. Right now, not to counteract the reality that we're Christians and we can be servants in government, but the notion that you only have one God. And if government is the God, right, and for socialism, communism, these dictators, tyrants, they want to be the God figure. Therefore, we need to secularize as much as we can. And part of secularizing means we have to erase history, because we recognize the Judeo-Christian heritage of this nation, or the purpose and point of the Constitution. The only way we can embrace socialism first, we have to get rid of the Constitution. But this is where even changing history becomes important, because we're never going to get rid of the Constitution as long as the guys who gave us the Constitution are heroes of this nation. But if you can villainize the heroes, then whatever they did now becomes tarnished, right? So these terrible white racist, right, slave-owning founding fathers did this terrible document that's, you know, anti-whatever, all the negative things said about it. Well, then we have to get rid of all those things, and because we've lost history, we've lost the connection to the Judeo-Christian ethic. The only way America's been able to function so well for so long was the moral underpinnings. Because John Adams says, right, our Constitution was made only for a moral and a religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Understanding, in our nation, we believe in giving freedom to people. Well, freedom is awesome, but it's only awesome if you have moral neighbors, right? Because you give freedom to immoral people, it's not fun anymore. Because now people are doing immoral things. Freedom only works when there's an underlying system of morality. And that's what the founding fathers, even the ones who we might argue weren't Christians necessarily, even like Benjamin Franklin, we might have an interesting discussion, but at the end of his life, he wrote a letter where he said, I'm not really sure about Jesus being the Son of God. Well, then I would say, probably you're not a Christian, because there's no other name under heaven given by men by which we must be saved, right? So you gotta know Jesus, that's important. But even Franklin, as governor of Pennsylvania, said that we need everybody going to church, everybody studying the Bible, because Pennsylvania will only function well if we have that moral underpinning. And so now when we have a society, we have a government that's encouraging the secularization of the nation, you only encourage secularization when you remove morality. It doesn't allow freedom to work, but if you don't want there to be freedom, if you want to have control, if you want socialism, if you want communism, if you want the dictator, then you need there to be enough of a crisis that you can step in and say, it's okay. I'm from the government, I'm here to help, I'll solve this problem. But you have to demonize the founding fathers, demonize the Constitution, and remove God, because in a nation, there's only two options. There's either a big God or a big government. You don't have both.
Delegitimize America.
Yes.
I would just add that. Delegitimize the country itself.
There's an interesting study done by Yale a few years back, and it looked at 33 different nations around the world. And it found that whatever degree that government care of the people, government welfare, whatever degree that increased, to that exact degree, church attendance decreased in the nation. So the bigger government got, the more secular the nation got, the bigger it got, the less people went to church, relied on God. You're going to choose either God or government. And so in the free market system, we've chosen God. And the other thing I'd point out, even historically, because we're talking about Democrat socialism, and the example of Chavez is great. Vote for Chavez and they're socialists. That's one of the big reasons that we, let me say it differently. If we still knew what form of government we had, we wouldn't be open to that. Because even the talk that we're a democracy is fundamentally violative of fundamental principles. A democracy is a government of men. A republic is a government of laws. We've always put laws above men. But if you're going to have a democracy, then you elect someone and that person makes the law. In ours, we've always said, no, we have a law, a constitution, the laws of God, whatever, and all you guys we elect are going to be subject to that law. That's why even our constitution forbids us from becoming a democracy. We're required to be a republic. Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, that's the highest form of government. But as John Adams pointed out, it also takes the greatest amount of care. You have to really watch that government be a good steward. And the more sloppy we get with, well, republic, democracy, it's all the same thing. Well, they both have elections. Now you're starting to elevate people above law. And when you do that, you're going to have a different form of government. And if you're going to have a democracy, why not go to socialism and have democratic socialism? And so even our lack of history about civics is contributing to this problem we've got with socialism and free market.
We had this vision of the U.S. as if it was utopia. And as a little girl, every time you see or hear anything about the United States, it was like, wow. That's the place to be.
I love being an American citizen. I still very clearly remember the day when I went and got my citizenship and got to wave the flag and say the oath.
I think you should understand that a lot of people in almost in all the world, they want to come to US.
One thing was strange to me when I came to United States. I thought, gosh, these people are so happy, smiling. I said, and I thought to myself, are they faking it? Is it even truth? Is it possible?
This is what I saw, a better in America, better lifestyle in America, better, you know, just your food.
One of the most surprising things for us when we came here to US was walking into a grocery store and seeing that everything was available. You can just touch things, you can choose, you had a variety.
What I noticed right away, how this country has everything. For example, if you would go to the stores, you can buy everything you want to.
The supermarkets, when I went in first time and seeing the options and availability of different items, and it was overwhelming. I've never seen anything like that.
When I came to the U.S. and I went into an American supermarket, I was, oh my God, this is like paradise. What is this?
The fact that we could just reach out and touch them and put them into our cart was something we've never encountered before.
Produce department here at our supermarkets, it's a fruit and vegetable galore. Coming here is just like, oh my gosh, look at this. Look, I mean, it was very different, very different.
The first time I walked into a Safeway store when we had just arrived, I just remember just being shocked that no one was running for the food. Like if that had, so I saw, I had never seen citrus fruits because of course Uzbekistan can't grow them. And I had never seen a pineapple. I didn't know what that was, or a grapefruit. I'd never seen those things. So I walked in and I remember seeing these things that it was a pineapple, I later found out, but things that were obviously food and fruit of every kind you can imagine. And just laying out there, it brought me such thankfulness to have come to a country where food was plentiful and available.
Oh my gosh, huge plates. I was so like, this is my like breakfast, lunch, two dinners, you know, when the first time I ordered, freedom of choice and a choice of anything. Like honestly, in 2006, when I came here and said, just choose whatever you want. I opened the menu and I could not choose because I want it all. At the same time, I knew I could not have it all, but at the same time, the choice was so hard to choose only because there's so much to choose.
If you're gonna go to a restaurant in the United States and they give you such a huge portions, and my first reaction was that I thought that they brought a meal for three of us, for me and my friends, in a one plate.
When I came here, I couldn't understand. I just couldn't comprehend. I had to learn culture, banking, and everything. I mean, it's just like night and day.
I love the fact that I can move around the country freely. If I want to go and visit my relatives in Florida, I can do that. I don't have to report to anyone or, again, be afraid of leaving the boundaries of my confined space.
Coming here now, right now, you can breathe this new air.
I love that American government has checks and balances and that the branches of government help to balance each other out so all the power is not locked in the hands of one man who can change the rules at any time and rule the country any way that he wants. Really, there is no dictatorship in America right now. And we lived under dictatorship, under socialism. And I'm glad we don't have that here.
I think that's the difference here, is you still have a voice and you can still have those grassroots movements that can make a difference. And that's huge.
We came here legally and the U.S. has been good to us. And so it's really sad to see where this country is going. I would not have the life I have now in Guyana.
And I think the parallel is there for Americans, you know, because it's based on principles of the Bible, moral principles and godly principles of the Bible. So it's outlasted every other government system because really the principles in the American Constitution and how it's governed is all based on the Bible, which is eternal and true. So I think that's why it's been around for so long, and that's why this country has done so well.
We hope you've been blessed by watching this teaching of a biblical worldview on socialism. Biblical Worldview is brought to you by Andrew Womack Ministries and Charis Bible College.
In the beautiful town of Woodland Park, Charis Bible College has been changing people's lives for over 25 years.
The people here are so like-minded. They want to help you grow.
These are people who genuinely care about you. They want the best for you.
Be prepared to be blown away with the teachings.
It's not just a season in your life.
There's no way you can't change.
You can't really go wrong going to a place that you get to sit and listen to the Word for 4 hours a day.
Being under the Word that much just allowed God to pour so much into me.
If you feel supernatural peace about coming to Charis, that's God.
I know you're like, how, when, where, all these questions, just do it. The Lord will provide.
I was doubting and second-guessing it, but when I took that step of faith, immediately, like, things were provided.
Just being around like-minded believers, teachers who are there for you and ready to talk to you at any moment and answer your questions, there's just nothing like it.
Just follow the leading of the one that you serve, and that's always going to be the right direction to go.
Go to charisbiblecollege.org to register today.